listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
Thursday saw an interesting exchange between the U.S. and China across half a globe. We begin at a press conference held by China's Foreign Minister Wang Yi in Beijing at the National People's Congress on Thursday.
Dear members of the press, good morning. At the outset, I wish to extend festive greetings to all Chinese women, including the female journalists in this room. I also wish to thank the press, Chinese and foreign, for having shown understanding and support for China's foreign policy and external relations. Everything we have accomplished, you have played a part. Thank you. Now I'm ready to take your questions.
谢谢主持人，外长您好，我是人民日报的记者。
People's Daily. Since the 18th National Congress of the Communist Party of China, China has made unprecedented progress in its foreign relations, which is widely praised across the country. Following the 19th Party Congress, what will be the highlights of China's diplomatic agenda this year?
党的十八大以来， 在习近平同志为核心的党中央的政协领导之下，
Under the outstanding leadership of the CPC Central Committee, with Comrade Xi Jinping at its core since the 18th Party Congress 5 years ago, we have traveled on the road of major country diplomacy that reflects China's distinct vision, style, and values. Producing historic accomplishments, our diplomatic efforts have been instrumental to upholding China's interests and dignity and to facilitating China's reform and development. Last October, General Secretary Xi Jinping emphasized in his report to the 19th Party Congress that China will work with other countries to foster a new type of international relations and to build a global community with a shared future. This is the aim of China's major country diplomacy in the new era.
2018年是贯彻落实十大精神的开局之年。
2018 is the first year for implementing the decisions of the 19th Party Congress, guided by Xi Jinping's thought on socialism with Chinese characteristics for a new era. We in the diplomatic service will take new steps and make new advances. The main highlights of China's diplomatic calendar will include the following four events we're going to host. First, the Bao Forum for Asia annual conference, which will take place in Hainan this April, and focus on reform and opening up. In this 40th anniversary year of reform and opening up, we will review China's successful experience and sketch new possibilities for reform and opening up in the new era. Second, the Shanghai Cooperation Organization Summit, which will take place in Qingdao this June, and focus on revitalizing the Shanghai spirit. The expanded SCO will rededicate itself to the Shanghai spirit of mutual trust and benefit, equal-footed consultation, respect for diversity of civilizations, and pursuit of common development. The summit will set the SCO on a new journey of consolidation and growth. Third, the Forum on China-Africa Cooperation Summit, which will take place in Beijing this September, and focus on the Belt and Road Initiative. A great opportunity for our African brothers and sisters to participate fully in the BRI. The summit will give new impetus to the China-Africa Comprehensive Strategic Partnership. Fourth, the first China International Import Expo, which will take place in Shanghai this December, and focus on the further market opening. China will embrace the world with open arms and enormous market potential. All will be welcome to access and benefit from the new opportunities of China's development. China's diplomatic agenda for 2018 are unfolding even as we speak. In the new era, we will work harder to see that China will enjoy a better environment for development and make greater contributions to human progress. Thank you.
下一个问题。白冰，中区第二排第四位这位先生，唱绿衣服。
Thank you, Foreign Minister. I'm from Reuters. I have a North Korea-related question for you. China has always said that one of the most important issues in the North Korea crisis is for there to be direct talks between North Korea and the United States. So what role does China have to facilitate such talks? And does China also believe that the United States needs to withdraw its military forces in South Korea for there to be a lasting peace on the Korean Peninsula? Thank you.
路透社，中国一直高度重视朝美的直接谈判，请问中国在这方面可以发挥什么作用？ This is the hottest topic in the world today. Seizing the opportunity of the Pyeongchang Olympics, the DPRK and the ROK have had a succession of interactions and achieved a rapid thaw in their relations, reversing the long-standing chill on the Korean Peninsula. The recent developments may seem baffling to some people,but are actually within the bounds of reason. During the Winter Games, the DPRK did not conduct any nuclear test, and the US and the ROK suspended their joint exercises targeting the DPRK. This proves that China's proposal of suspension for suspension was the right prescription for the problem and created basic conditions for the improvement of inter-Korean relations.
现在半导问题的解决终于朝正确方向。
The Korean Peninsula issue has finally taken an important step in the right direction. China fully commends and supports the efforts made by the two Koreas. To return the peninsula to peace and the nuclear issue to the track of dialogue, these initial steps must be followed up by corresponding and concerted efforts by the parties. To this end,We call on the parties, particularly the US and the DPRK, to engage in dialogue sooner rather than later. We encourage the parties to follow a dual-track approach of remaining committed to the goal of denuclearization and working actively to establish a peace mechanism on the peninsula. By addressing the parties' legitimate security concerns, including those of the DPRK,in exchange for and in tandem with progress towards denuclearization. And this is China's long-standing position and also the vision set forth in the relevant Security Council resolutions.
我还要说的是，冰冻三尺非一日之寒。
Of course, it takes more than one cold day to freeze 3 feet of ice. Despite light at the end of the tunnel, the journey ahead won't be smooth. History has reminded us time and again that whenever tension subsided on the peninsula, the situation would be clouded by various interferences. Now is a crucial moment for testing the sincerity of the parties. Peace must be fought for. Opportunity needs to be seized. It falls to all parties to bear in mind the imperative of peace and the well-being of people in the region. All must demonstrate political courage and make a political decision to expeditiously carry out all necessary and useful engagements, both bilateral and plurilateral, and to do their best to restart dialogue and negotiation for the peaceful settlement of the nuclear issue. China will continue to make unremitting efforts for this outcome. Thank you.
谢谢，请继续提问。左边第四排这位女士。
China Central Television.
谢谢主持人，我是中央电视台央视网央视新闻移动网的记者。The
Chinese people can tell that in the last 5 years, President Xi has been fully engaged in China's foreign policy. His personal diplomacy has enhanced China's image as a major country entering a new era, presented his image as a global statesman, and raised China's standing and international influence like never before. How do you see the role and impact of diplomacy conducted by President Xi as head of state? Head of state diplomacy, as the highest form of state-to-state interaction, plays a pivotal role and has irreplaceable strategic value. Since 2012, President Xi Jinping has been the chief architect of China's major country diplomacy. He was personally involved in the planning and the conduct of head of state diplomacy, which by all accounts has been brilliant. To date, President Xi has visited 57 countries in different parts of the world and received more than 110 foreign heads of state. These important visits and meetings go a long way towards deepening the world's understanding of China, enhancing China's profile and influence, and facilitating the solution of many global problems. President Xi's leadership and charisma have earned him and his country many good friends among foreign leaders who represent a diverse range of cultures and social systems.
2018年除了主持刚才所说的四大主场活动之外,
in the year ahead, President Xi will host the 4 diplomatic events I mentioned earlier, and he will also participate in the BRICS summit in South Africa, the APEC Economic Leaders Meeting in Papua New Guinea, and the G20 summit in Argentina. We believe that President Xi's personal diplomacy will make a positive and responsible contribution to the welfare of his people, the interests of China, and the well-being of the world. It will write a whole new chapter of major country diplomacy with Chinese characteristics in the new era. Thank you.
好，谢谢。下一个问题，右区第三排，这边第一个，马月。
Bloomberg.
您好，我是彭博社的记者，美国总统特朗普。
U.S. President Donald Trump has said he will use all tools at his disposal to prevent China's state economic model from undermining international competition. How will China respond to that? Thank you.
谢谢。你这个问题本身就很有攻击性。
This is a quite sharp question. As the foreign minister, let me reiterate for you China's policy towards the China-US relationship. Our two countries are agreed that we share broad interests and important responsibilities for global peace, stability, and prosperity. Our two countries are to carry out broad-based cooperation on the basis of mutual benefit, manage our differences on the basis of mutual respect, deepen mutual understanding and friendship between our people, and work together to address major regional and global challenges. Our two countries must work for the sustained, healthy, and steady growth of our relations.
合作应对重大的地区和全球性挑战。
Cooperation is the main thrust of China-US relations, and there are broad-based and close interactions between the two countries. According to the latest poll, over 50% of the American people have a favorable view of China. The figure has been rising steadily in recent years, and the figure I've just cited is the highest one in nearly 30 years. So I hope people will not just focus on the problems in China-US relations, but will also pay attention to the positive aspects. As the world's largest developing and the largest developed country, the top two economies and permanent members of the UN Security Council, China and America working together will benefit not just our own countries, but also the whole world. If there is any competition between us, it has to be healthy and positive. In fact, their competition aside, China and the United States don't have to be rivals, but we should strive to be partners in cooperation.
中国将继续坚持走自己选择的。
China is determined to stay on the path it has chosen, and China's development and revitalization is unstoppable. This is the consensus of the international community. Some Americans see China as a strategic competitor and allege that China will replace America's role in the world. This strategic conclusion is fundamentally wrong. China is on the path of socialism with distinctive Chinese characteristics.China's success is underpinned by its commitment to peaceful development and win-win cooperation. China's path is completely different from that of traditional powers, and as such, is commended and welcomed by a growing number of countries. The truth is, the more China develops, the more contribution China will be make to the world. China is on a long march to modernization. It has no need or intention to displace America. China and America must respect each other, combine our strengths, and pursue win-win cooperation on the basis of the three joint communiques and our common understandings. China-US relations have gone through a lot in the past few decades, but dialogue and cooperation has always carried the day. It is the wise thing to do.There can be no alternative.
That was China's Foreign Minister Wang Yi in Beijing on Thursday at the National People's Congress. A few hours later, in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia, U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson held a press conference with the chair of the African Union Commission, Musa Faki Mahamat. We bring you that in its entirety.
Well, first, let me thank Chairperson Faki for taking the time to meet with me. We had a very good meeting when I was able to host him at the high-level dialogue in Washington this past November when we met with many other African leaders as well. And I'm really pleased to be here in the continent, and I expressed to the chairperson and his colleagues that it was appropriate that I begin my visit to Africa here with the African Union leaders as well. The African Union truly is a force for good, and we're grateful to the African Union's role in seeking solutions to help this continent move towards greater stability. Recognizing health security also advances national security, economic development, political stability. We applaud the Africa Centers for Disease Control, which has been quite successful in tracking and responding to disease outbreaks on the continent. We look forward to continuing our close cooperation with the African Union on this important initiative, and we're currently in very important discussions to update our joint memorandum of understanding to guide our future efforts, our collaborative efforts in that regard. On trade, we also support the Africa Union's economic regional integration efforts to lower intra-trade barriers on the continent, boost more intra-regional trade, which we know has been a central goal of the negotiations around the Continental Free Trade Agreement, which we are quite supportive of. We look forward to engaging further with the African Union once that agreement is in place on how this will also promote greater participation of U.S. private sector business interests as well. I mentioned to Chairperson Faki that we appreciate the African Union's very strong statements made on South Sudan at the recent AU summit. We truly call on all parties to abide by the cessation of hostilities and be open to compromise for the good of the South Sudanese people. We urge the AU and the Intergovernmental Authority on Development to keep their maximum efforts of moving forward to push for a solution to this conflict for the good of the people in South Sudan. I also appreciate Chairperson Faki's role in leading the African Union through a number of security challenges, and as you might imagine, that was a substantive part of our discussion today as well. The African Union's mission in Somalia, clearly an example of countries coming together to counter terrorism, promote stability, and enable delivery of much-needed aid to the Somali people. We encourage the African Union to continue these efforts. We will continue our own efforts as well. We've not yet won that battle in Somalia, and we must stay at it. We also discussed ways to ensure the G5 Sahel sources have the necessary resources to continue their fight against terrorism and how we can put in place more sustainable funding models where they have greater certainty around how to plan the future fight against terrorism in the Sahel region as well. And we applaud the brave efforts of the part of the G5 Sahel forces. We discussed African Union reform and the chairperson's efforts to increase member state financing for the African Union and really put in place a more sustainable funding model with greater certainty as well. Last year's self-financing of African Union programs expanded to more than 40%, which is up from 26% just the prior year. So clearly the chairperson's efforts are yielding very good results. Fighting corruption is another area of common cause, and we're very pleased to see that the African Union has named 2018 as the year for winning the fight against corruption. From high-level secret deals to petty bribes on the street, corruption really does steal the precious resources from job creators and entrepreneurs and others who would promote benefits to the greater society and to the citizens of those countries. Good governance and transparency are essential to creating the conditions for economic growth and prosperity, and we look forward to continuing our joint efforts with the African Union to improve the business environment on the continent. But transparency really is an essential requirement for good business conditions and will attract greater investment and economic activity as well. That includes supporting greater intra and global trade investments in Africa as the environment creates competitive conditions. And finally, I reiterate our desire for more African nations to apply concrete diplomatic and economic pressure on North Korea. The goal of the Global Maximum Pressure Campaign, which has been supported by multiple UN Security Council resolutions, is to motivate North Korea to achieve the complete, verifiable, and irreversible denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula. African nations can contribute to this goal, and we need country by country for nations to take action to support this international effort towards a denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula. Again, I want to thank Chairperson Faki for his warm welcome and the hospitality during our discussions here at the African Union, and most importantly, for your leadership of the African Union. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairperson.
Thank you very much, Excellency. I'll now open the floor to questions, and in honor of International Women's Day, I'll take the first question from a female reporter, and I'll invite one of our guests from the American Media Corps to ask a question. Ms. Nike?
Mr. Secretary, this is your first trip to Africa as a top U.S. diplomat. You are calling it a listening tour, but how much listening do you expect to be doing about the president's allegedly derogatory remarks? How committed is the United States to the security and investment in Africa? Separately, what is your message to AU on the proposal to self-finance by levying tariffs on imports. Chairman Faki, if I may, first question. Ethiopia is a host of AU and a member. How concerned are you about the decision to impose a state of emergency that restricts freedom of speech? And do you believe the arbitrary detentions have violated people's rights? Separately, has the AU requested an apology for the U.S. President's recent remarks? Thank you very much.
Well, the United States and the African continent have enjoyed many years of very strong and positive relationships. In fact, we have diplomatic relations with some countries on the continent that span more than a century now. With the creation of the African Union, it has provided yet another area in which we can cooperate, collaborate to address security issues more broadly on the continent, as we've discussed in both of our remarks, and bring greater stability to the continent, and to discuss ways in which we can create economic prosperity, which will attract U.S. foreign direct investment. So the purpose of my trip to this continent is to listen. I think it is important that we listen to what the priorities of the countries here on the continent are and see where there is good alignment between their priorities and our areas of greatest interest as well. And I think we've already found there are many. And that should not surprise anyone. We have important joint security activities underway, and we appreciate the commitment made by many countries on the continent, not just with their own financial resources, but with their own men and women in uniform who are going right out on the front lines to fight this war against terror that we all are fighting globally. So this is an important trip. I think it is an indication of the importance the continent plays in the future of the United States, both from a security but also an economic standpoint. Africa as a continent is going to undergo significant population growth. Five of the world's fastest growing, 12 fastest growing economies are here in Africa. So clearly there is significant opportunity for American interest in the future. So it's important that we have very open dialogue with one another to understand our priorities and to understand how we align those priorities, and we support each other. So this is a vitally important continent to the U.S. and our future interest as well. I think with respect to the support for the counterterrorism efforts, we had a very good exchange on various ways that we can consider creating a more sustainable and certain funding model for the counterterrorism efforts, both not just through the G5 Sahel, but also AMISOM and other activities to win win the war against terror on the battlefield. But we also discussed the need to win the war in the social media and cyberspace as well. With Africa's very large and growing youth population, we must create good opportunities for education, for future jobs, so that the youth of Africa do not become easy targets for recruiting violent extremist messaging. And we had a good discussion about that as well today. So very broad canvas of a common interest that we have to discuss.
Before I reply to the question on Ethiopia, I want to add that I am satisfied with the discussions that I have had with the Secretary of State Tillerson. The commitment of the United States to support the African continent in its fight against terrorism, whether it is the Horn of Africa, the support to AMISOM, or in the Sahel, whether it is to support the G5 Sahel joint force through the mobilization of financial and material resources in order to support these important missions. As regards Ethiopia, I would like to recall that in the beginning of the year, that is in January, the Ethiopian government has adopted a number of measures, that is to expand and open up the democratic and political space. And I react to this important decision by encouraging the Ethiopian authorities and also congratulate them on this important decision. We have also followed the resignation of the Prime Minister, whom I met later on, and also the commitment of the authorities of this country, that is, in a consensual manner, to pursue and continue the reforms and to have a representative government. It is an ongoing process. And we have been reassured by the authorities of the country, and we think that in a concerted manner, through dialogue, through consensus, this is the way the country can move forward. You know, Ethiopia is an important country. Not only it is the headquarters, hosting the headquarters of the African Union, but also its role it plays in the region. So the situation in Ethiopia is of capital importance, and I've been reassured by the authorities that the political and social forces of this country, through consultation and dialogue, will find a formula that will allow this country to pursue and continue its way, because at the economic level it has produced very substantive results, and we hope the reforms will enable the country to move forward.
Thank you very much, Chair and Secretary. Mr. Chair, my question is, at the moment there is no clear policy towards Africa from President Donald Trump's administration. Does that bother you? Do you want more from the U.S. administration at the moment? Number two, Mr. Tillerson, you've made a statement about China, saying that China encouraged dependency, utilized corrupt deals, and endangered its, Africa's natural resource. Is it something that you want to say again, and what's the base of that? And Mr. Chair, do you agree with the comments of Mr. Tillerson? Final question. President Donald Trump, we've heard, has called Africa and Africans. This is something that Africa is still digesting. Do you agree with that? And do you believe President Donald Trump owes Africans an apology? Thank you very much.
And we will bring you Secretary of State Rex Tillerson's answer to that question in a later newscast. And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. Is a global trade war imminent? If Donald Trump follows through on increasing tariffs and upending existing trade deals, it seems very likely. After all, this was at the very center of his campaign for the presidency. It was a promise he made to his base. Will it make America great again? Crosstalking Trade Wars, I'm joined by my guest, Mitch Feierstein in New York. He is a fund manager and author of the book, Planet Ponzi. Also in New York, we have Ann Lee. She's a former adjunct professor at NYU, and her latest book is Will China's Economy Collapse? And in Brussels, we have Steve Keen. He is a distinguished professor at University College London. All right, crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump in anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. To all of you, before I ask the first question, I'd like to reflect on something that Pat Buchanan wrote a couple days ago. The title of his article is, Why is the GOP Terrified of Tariffs? And this is what he has to say. From Lincoln to William McKinley to Theodore Roosevelt, and from Warren Harding to Calvin Coolidge, the Republican Party erected the most awesome manufacturing machine the world has ever seen. He continues to say, the U.S. relied on tariffs to convert from an agricultural economy in 1800 to the mightiest manufacturing power on earth by 1900. A very strong advocate of what I suppose what the president is going to be doing when it comes to global trade. Let me go to Anne first. Reflect upon those words, because in the mainstream media, it's all gloom and doom. I think part of it is it's because of what it's this president that is saying it, because we had Bush and Obama looking at increasing duties on a number of things, and it would focus quite a bit on China. So maybe Trump is amplifying it, but I think it's still pretty much a political football. Anne in New York, go ahead.
Yes, certainly there is some association with Trump that's making it unpopular. But generally speaking, I think a lot of folks have recognized that a real trade war would really damage U.S. interests because the U.S. Is very reliant on imports from around the world. Many U.S. companies have operations elsewhere, especially in China. And so having tariffs would essentially just hurt their own bottom line. Mm-hmm. And this is basically a boomerang. And so why would you want to hurt your own companies is basically how they see it. And so I think that there is growing recognition that that would be a really bad policy. And aside from just political rhetoric. And so I think that folks are trying to raise that point. Gary Cohen may have raised it, but has been unsuccessful.
You know, Mitch. You know, let's stick with the politics of it before we get into the nuts and bolts here. Is Trump just bluffing the world? I mean, is it just part of his political style? I mean, it is quite interesting here. I mean, I think all of us, I mean, to one degree or another, know basic economics. Obviously, tariffs are not a good idea. We can look at the 1930s, the most recent experience. It was a disaster. Disaster for the global economy. No, okay. Steve says no, but let me go to Mitch first. Go ahead.
I think that there are a lot of moving parts to this that we have to consider. And you know, whenever you have a complex situation, you try to simplify it as best possible. Like the president uses one word sound bites or 140 characters in a tweet to try to get a message out. Now, what we have going on here is geopolitics and neoliberalism and its failure over the past 30 or 40 years. So what we've got to do is identify the threats that we have, and the United States and the fake news media always says that Russia is the biggest threat. It's a little difficult to fathom that when you think that Russia's GDP is somewhere in the neighborhood of $1.2 trillion and China's is up near $13 trillion if you believe their numbers, which none of which are probably credible. That is one of the biggest threats, rather, in terms of the amount of the quantum of money that the United States owes. So as you posited, is this just a bluff? I would say it could be a bluff, but we don't really know. Will it work? Probably not. Will it help with the $1.2 trillion we have outstanding or China has in our debt, in the United States debt? Not really sure. But one thing is for sure, and I've said this many times before, you have, first of all, it started with a currency war. I said a currency war will lead to a trade war, which could potentially end with a hot war.
Okay, Steve, you were disagreeing as I was speaking. I don't remember exactly what I was saying, but I like when people disagree. Jump in. Go ahead in Brussels.
Well, you were saying that we're all about basic economics, and that says tariffs are a bad thing. Basic economics is wrong, and it's been wrong both theoretically and empirically for a long, long time. Just to give you the most obvious example of that is the Bank of England and the Bundesbank have both come out and said that the way that textbooks teach about money creation is frankly wrong. And if you get the Bank of England saying that the economists don't understand money, it's a pretty bad start to the credibility of economics. So what we've been taught for a long, long time is that specialization is better. The more specialized we are, the better off we are. And empirically, that's been a failure. There's very good research by a guy called Danny Roddick, who you should have on the show one day, who has shown that countries which have actually industrialized faster are the ones that followed protection.
Exactly.
And that includes America, as you mentioned, the early protectionist breakup. Yeah.
That's what I mentioned.
That was America's success, was to capture.
Keep going.
Yeah. So the theoretical argument is simply wrong. It's a very interesting fallacy. I send up in a cartoon book I call Econ Comics, by the way, a con job that made people think about specialization in terms of labor and ignoring the fact that you can't shift machinery from one industry to another. Now, what Trump, I don't think everyone understand the pictures in the cartoon book, let alone the logic behind it. But what he is identifying is the gut feeling of many, many people
exactly.
have got in the Midwest of America.
Exactly.
They've been screwed by trade wars.
Exactly.
And they're right. They live in what we now call the Rust Belt. We call it the Rust Belt because factories which used to produce stuff there have turned to rust because you simply can't move industry from steel manufacturing to making silicon chips. You simply let the machinery rust. He's saying, I'm going to get the jobs back over there. Now, he's not necessarily doing it in an intelligent fashion, but he has got hold of something that is real and a gut feeling that affects a lot of Americans who will vote for him again because of
this. Exactly. Let me go to Anne here. That's exactly what I was thinking, too. Anne, we'll I'm going to agree with what you said earlier. At the end of the day, it will probably hurt the American economy and maybe hurt the American worker. But that's not the perception. I mean, and this is a campaign promise. And he made a lot of promises that I really worried that he wouldn't keep. But he's doing it. All right. And so this is, again, it's more about perception of leadership. And he's speaking to his base. OK, I don't know if it's going to bring those jobs back. But if I'm in the Rust Belt and I hear that there's going to be a tariff on steel, even though the U.S. gets only 3% from China, but it's still the perception. And I think that's what he's angling on. Go ahead, Ann.
Well, so let me just respond to what the other person said. Yes, it's been known that countries need to protect their infant industries in order to grow them to be competitive enough in the global economy. And then you let them set them free and compete as hard as they can once they're strong enough. The U.S. already did that. And the U.S. is an industrialized nation. U.S. doesn't need to, you know, protect infant industries because it's no longer infants. It's basically, you know, old age at this point, probably, because there are steel companies all over the world. And if they can't compete with other steel companies in other parts of the world, then they're doing something wrong. And maybe that's because of, you know, labor rates being too high here, or regulations, or who knows what.
Or bad trade deals anymore. Or bad trade deals like NAFTA. That's why this is happening.
Peter,
go ahead, Mitch.
Peter, the trade deals that you're talking about.
Hang on, let me go to Mitch first. Go ahead, Mitch.
The trade deals, there are a lot of bad trade deals out there. There's TPP out there that should be shot down. And this was all part of a globalized or globalization effort. So that we have some bad trade deals that need to be scrubbed from the books. But we've got to also look at, as I said, there are a lot of moving parts. The crux of the issue is, and I agree with Steve Keen, where he said that part of economic theory has gone amiss. And it certainly has. If you look at the Federal Reserve's economic modeling, it's totally wrong. A lot of these have been totally wrong. Central bank money printing has hit a fever pitch where they've got $10 trillion on their books, right? And they've only produced maybe $10 trillion out of the $10 trillion, $2 trillion in quantifiable. So that's what, a ratio of 5 to 1 or something? So we're not getting any organic growth from what they're doing. And what they've done is they've destroyed capitalism by printing quantums of money.
It is
so I think we need to get back. Right. If we're going to have, have capitalism, we've got to...
What you're saying is this the financialization of the economy where it doesn't make anything and you don't need anybody to, if you don't make anything, you don't need workers. Right. Okay, this is what's happened here. Steve, before we go to the break, you wanted to jump in there.
Stop.
Go ahead.
Yeah.
Go to Steve. Go ahead. In Brussels.
Yeah, because Trump keeps on talking about making bad trade deals. You know what the worst trade deal America ever made was? It was insisting that the American dollar become the reserve currency for the planet. Because what that meant was, if any other countries wanted to trade with each other, they had to buy American dollars above and beyond the demand they had for American goods. Now, that means, of course, the American dollar is higher than it would be if we had what Keynes proposed, which was the bancor, an international currency owned by no country, administered through the IMF. If that was done, America's exchange rate may be 20% lower, and it wouldn't need to complain about bad competition in manufacturing. So there's lots and lots of ways in which this has been done by America trying to be the exception of the planet and making a stupid trade deal that they think made it look good. Plus also, there's an enormous excess of steel on the global market, largely due to China's enormous stimulus program. And that is part of the reason why America's complaining about dumping, and they've got a point.
Okay, and let me go to you. Let's start talking about China. Is this really just about China? Go ahead, Ann.
I think it is largely about China. This global tariff really is because they're worried about China's steel going through other countries and coming into the U.S., so they want to close off all doors. So, yes, it is targeted at China, but then there's going to be a lot of collateral damage as a result. And so, the administration is going about with very blunt tools. It's clearly not gaining friends from their allies.
We'll get to talk about that after the break.
Trade issue as such.
I'm going to a short break, and after that short break, we'll continue our discussion on trade war. Stay with RT.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Okay, right before we went to the break, Ann gave the operative word retaliation, okay? Mitch, you know, there's a couple of things here. We already know that the Europeans and the Canadians are talking together. The Chinese have made it very clear they're not going to take this sitting down. And I think we have to remember, folks, is that there's been a lot of pressure, at least rhetorically, from the Trump administration on China to, quote unquote, take care of North Korea, which is illusory. They don't have as much influence as they think. But now the Koreans are going to be in the target of tariffs here. And that this is a time when the North and South are talking about possibly some kind of rapprochement, which Washington isn't very happy about. This is adding insult to injury if the South Koreans are going to be sanctioned in this way by the United States through tariffs. Go ahead, Mitch.
Yeah, I think that U.S. dollar hegemony is a big part of this puzzle. And Steve mentioned briefly, you know, the problem with the U.S. dollar being the world's reserve currency for the past 100 years. I mean, I think eventually there's going to be, and it's going to happen soon, we're going to have a currency that you can exchange for either gold, silver, oil or something. And it's going to actually be backed by something other than a promise to repay something that can never be repaid. And as you're saying, a lot of the countries will start to realize that it's going to be impossible for the U.S. to ever pay back its debt.
Yep.
And this money that's been printed that has ended up financing and enabling a grotesque asset bubble in stocks, bonds and property and corporate stock buybacks and leveraged buyouts, leverage, too much debt, credit and leverage will end very badly with the U.S. dollar taking it on the chin and the other countries realizing we're going to have to come up with a different solution for a global currency.
You know, Steve, again, I brought up the issue of bluffing, but the United States' share of the global economy and trade is year after year gets smaller and smaller. I mean, does the United States does it misunderstand how essential it is to the global economy? I mean, we have other vectors of growth. We actually in Sub-Saharan Africa, there's a lot of growth now. Of course, there's the whole China issue here. I mean, can the United States dictate trading patterns and laws and realities the way it think it can, because I don't think it can as much. And it's dwindling with every single year. Go ahead, Steve.
Well, a large part of the why America's lost its share of global trade is a deliberate move by American transnationals to take advantage of low wages, particularly in China. I went to the construction of the very first free trade zone in China in 1981-82, the Shenzhen Free Trade Zone. And the explanation that the managers gave there, which was quite brilliant, was that they were going to take advantage of a loophole in the American tariff laws that let American corporations re-import goods they've exported to third world countries for further manufacturing and not pay any tariff on that work. And that would get them the technology. And at the same time, they saw what had happened with other free trade zones in the rest of Asia, where as soon as the wages rose, the companies would move on. They also insisted that each company had to have a Chinese partner, and within 5 years, the Chinese partner had to own 50% of the business. Now, the cut in costs that the American capitalists faced was so great, they were willing to do that. And of course, what they did was they increased their share of the income of the America, they reduced the share of the workers, benefited China dramatically, and now that in the long term, it's the fact that you have something vaguely resembling a democracy in America that meant the workers who got screwed by the process two ways are now starting to fight back, and Trump, unfortunately, is their champion.
You know, and, you know, I get the impression because, I mean, even before he was president, before the campaign, Trump was always big on trade. I mean, you know, awful trade deals and all that. Does he look at this as a silver bullet? Because the U.S. economy, there's so many things that ail it. And it's a very complicated thing. It's just not about trade. So, again, I go back to the political issues that he's presenting that he's, quote unquote, doing something. But is it going to be enough? Go ahead, Ann.
Oh, I certainly don't think it's enough. There is a lot that ails the U.S. economy. You've got a situation where there's just too much red tape. Many entrepreneurs actually can't get their products off the ground because they're stuck in areas where they are waiting and waiting for green lights, and frankly, they'd rather go test out their products in China, which has far fewer red tape. You have basically an educational system that's been failing most of American children.
Yeah.
So, a lot of people are just not prepared to be workers in this new 21st century knowledge economy, so to speak. There's so many issues that he would need to tackle, but he doesn't have the time to. His term is only 4 years. And so he's just going to go for whatever low-hanging fruit he can,
yeah,
just to at least please his base so that he,
yeah,
will have another shot or another term later.
I think that's a I agree. That's a really good conceptualization there, and it's low hanging fruit here. Mitch, for me, I was a trained historian. For me, what I think is really quite interesting is that if you look at after the Second World War, the United States made an amazing sweetheart deals with trade with its allies in Europe. We have it with South Korea. We had Japan, Taiwan, and that was a geopolitical expedient. OK, they wanted to keep the Western bloc, the goodies, to keep them in there. Okay, so they importing stuff into the United States. I can remember, in the 1960s, everybody laughed at Japanese products, the little plastic things. It was a joke. Okay, by the 1980s, it was a different tune, and we can repeat that also with the Chinese.
Yeah.
All right, I mean, because the United States did that for geopolitical reasons, it actually undermined its economy in the long run. Because I don't personally, and I'm agreeing with Ann, I don't see really a way out of this. Okay, because the people that have the money and the capital, they have financialized the economy. They make a lot of money off of it, but doesn't make anything for anybody else. Go ahead, Mitch.
Yeah, so what you're talking about is what I describe in my book, Planet Ponzi. Your financialization has ruined what we have today. You discussed after World War II, we had actual organic growth.
Yep.
So we had organic growth. We had organic growth, which drove the economies forward, and we had GDP in excess of where it is today. Global GDP is anemic at best, and the only growth that we're seeing is a derivation of central bank money printing.
Yeah.
So it's not, in reality, growth driven by product creation. It's growth driven by stock buybacks, leverage buybacks, and Wall Street creating, crony capitalism. And that's going to definitely end badly, because interest rates have gone from 15% in 1583 in 1981 down to close to zero. So the cost of finance, Ponzi finance today, is relatively too low. So it keeps the zombie companies in business. No organic growth is created. Real wages are the same level or lower for the average worker as they were in the 1980s, yet tuition costs are up 2,000%. Healthcare costs have spiraled out of control with Obamacare. So you've got a real problem, and the fake news media will do anything to destroy Trump, along with the deep state and the agents that want to control and have neoliberalism as the rule. Academia in America has turned into indoctrination.
Oh, it's a disaster.
Unfortunately.
It's a disaster.
So the landscape has changed. Not in a positive way.
And not in a positive way. Steve, one of the things is that a lot of Trump supporters and outlets that support him in the media, they like to really pound away the stock market. Well, correct me if I'm wrong, but I mean, ever since the late 80s, the stock market doesn't reflect the livelihood and prosperity of the average person in the United States. It certainly tells you about the super rich, okay, but it doesn't translate into the real economy. Steve.
Well, not by a long shot. And in fact, the stock market, the S&P, bottomed at 666 before the quantitative easing program began at the Fed. And that was supposed to stimulate demand through what they called the wealth effect, when their own research showed there was no wealth effect out of shares in terms of its impact upon aggregate demand. The only wealth effect they could find was out of rising housing, and even that was tenuous. Of course, that could collapse too, as it did back in 2008. So we have a bunch of people governing who are on the the Titanic, and they think they've got a sailboat at their command rather than a super liner. And this is our real problem. We have a lack of understanding of how capitalism actually functions in the minds of those who are trying to manage capitalism.
I want to you to apply your China expertise here. How will the Chinese react? They have a lot of assets and resources at hand, okay? And they have an economy that is expanding, really expanding. How are the Chinese going to react to this from Trump? Go ahead.
Well, I think they'll just take it on the chin. Mm. They probably already anticipate this. And they, I'm sure, have drawn up a list of things that they could retaliate. And I think among them would be areas where they feel that could hurt the U.S., where the U.S. is vulnerable. So where is U.S. vulnerable? Because the U.S. actually has, you know, a lot of agricultural products going to China. China is now growing more soybean and corn. So if they basically say, we're going to stop importing your soybean and corn, U.S., then a lot of the farmers are going to get upset. And this is also a big lobby in the U.S. They could also basically decide that they're not going to go forward with all the Boeing airplanes and turn to Airbus instead. And so this would also hurt, you know, U.S. manufacturing in a way. Oil and gas, another big U.S. export, and China was importing a huge number from the U.S. last year. But, you know, China basically is buying a huge chunk of Aramco from Saudi Arabia. They clearly are trying to secure other oil and gas from other countries like Russia. And so they're basically diversifying all their imports. And this way, if they decide that they don't want to import from the U.S., it would not be too painful for them. And so China is not going to just sit back and, you know, pretend that, you know, everything's okay and let the and let themselves be a punching bag. No, they're going to retaliate some way, but they're not probably going to make it too obvious. They will probably basically create new laws and say that
We've run out of time, and Anne's absolutely right. The second shoe will drop. Many thanks to my guests in New York and in Brussels, and thanks to our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time, and remember, Crosstalk rules.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.